I'm Roger Horowitz. I'm the author of Kosher USA, How Cook Became Kosher, and Other Tales of Modern Food. I'm a historian of American food. I work at the Hagley Library, and I teach history at the University of Delaware.
So tell me kind of how you began researching this book. You mentioned that in your prologue about your own personal family history and how that led you to research the topic.
Well, this is not a topic that I had originally planned to write about when I started off becoming a historian. It really was prompted by a question from my Uncle Stu, asked in the course of a very difficult evening and a very cold day in December. Stu was a very important uncle to us, a very smart man, and he took the time to read a prior book I had written called Putting Meat on the American Table, and he asked my mother why I hadn't talked about kosher meat in that book, which I thought was a very interesting question. I didn't call him right away, and he passed away. He was very ill when he asked that question, so we never had a conversation about it. But I thought about the question, and I thought that was very, very smart, because he was really asking two questions in one. One was, how could I write the history of meat in America, which I had written about, without talking about kosher meat? And it's true, I hadn't discussed it at all. His other piece of his question was, why hadn't I, as someone brought up in a Jewish household who was kosher, why didn't I think to include kosher meat in this book? Which, from your favorite uncle, is a pretty harsh question to be asked, and a very good question. So that started me thinking, and really led to my starting to look into this topic. Along the way, it's influenced a lot by my parents, especially my mother, who herself was a lawyer and a PhD in philosophy, and she shared with me a lot of her experiences as a girl and her parents' experiences growing up kosher, as did my father. So those family stories become tied up, you know, in this book in a way which is unusual for a book of history, which this is.
So tell me about some of your biggest discoveries in your research of this book.
Well, I started off looking at how did major products become kosher? I mean, where was kosher food in the middle part of the 20th century? How did Jews get kosher food if they wanted it? And there's a big transition. You know, early in the century, there were Jewish companies that made food that was for Jews, and there were stores that were run by observant Jews that made things that Jews could buy, and that's how you got your kosher food. This changes middle of the century when all sorts of branded goods come in, and Jews start finding themselves promoted as consumers of things like Aunt Jemima pancake mix, Coca-Cola, baking soda, coffee, all sorts of other kinds of products, spices, pickles, you know, tomato juice, all these things. And they're branded. And they're, how do you know if they're kosher? How do you know if they're kosher? So I think my discovery that was interesting early on is the biggest product early on to become kosher is Coca-Cola. And Coca-Cola becomes the first iconic product to become kosher in 1935. Then it's really not until the 60s or 70s where a lot of products become kosher, become more widely disseminated, where there's a process by which you can be sure the products are kosher.
Talk about that process a little bit of verifying if a food is actually kosher, and even the discrepancy about how someone might define kosher food.
Okay, well, it's two questions in one. I'll address the first one. Well, the problem of making a modern product kosher is that the kosher rules originate in an era before industrial food, where, you know, if you were told you couldn't eat pork, you know, you knew it was a pig or not. It was pretty clear. When you get into the middle, late 20th century, there's all sorts of ingredients in these products, and those ingredients might or might not come from a source that is kosher. So to determine whether a product is kosher, you have to have a merging of science, especially chemistry, and also production engineering with kosher law, which is a very curious combination, because kosher law is rooted in antiquity and in the Torah and the Talmud, you know, literally going back 2,000 or 3,000 years. Modern science is secular, it's very recent, and it's not something that the authorities in kosher law knew about or talked about when they wrote stuff in the aughts and in the middle of the 17th, 18th centuries. So kosher certification is emerging of these two areas of knowledge, where the rabbis who examine products have to also know chemistry. And the organizations that administer this kind of inspection need to know production engineering. They need to know how things are made. So what you see now on the packages in marketplaces are like U in a circle, a K in a circle, a K in a star. So those are symbols of kosher certification organizations that have investigated the product contents and tell the manufacturer that according to their rules, it is kosher. And the mark on the package is a trademark that they control, and that's what reassures consumers who are looking for the kosher mark that this is indeed certified kosher by an organization of rabbis.
And that came about with Coca-Cola becoming kosher?
Coca-Cola is the first, and the way that develops is Coca-Cola is a popular beverage in the 1920s. It becomes custom among Jews to serve it to children during the Passover Seder as an alternative to wine. And rabbis have to face the question, is it kosher for Passover? As the result of this conversation, rabbis start to contact a man named Rabbi Tobias Geffen, rabbi in Atlanta, who happens to be where Coke syrup is made. And under the Ashkenazi tradition, you ask the rabbi in the place where the food was made if it was kosher. He was in Atlanta. That's where the syrup came from. So they asked Rabbi Geffen if it was kosher. Geffen engages in this process of using science. He approaches the chemist for the state of Georgia to investigate the contents, and he discovers there's a problem. There's an ingredient in Coke called glycerin that is essentially a very minor agent. It's nothing wrong with it, but glycerin is derived from animal fats, and those animal fats include pig fat. So he says to Coke, sorry, Coke, you're not kosher because you've got glycerin that's derived from a pork-based source. But then he offers a solution. He, again, turning to science, he says, well, if you can get glycerin from another source that is kosher, then you're okay. Then you can put it in Coke and it'll be kosher. And they learn about that glycerin can be made from vegetable fats, as vegetable oils as well, such as cottonseed oil, which is widely available in the United States in a product called Crisco, which was widely used by the Jewish community. The Procter & Gamble company that makes Crisco, also the supplier for Coke's glycerin, Coke asks Procter & Gamble, can you generate some vegetable-based glycerin that's going to be kosher? Procter & Gamble says, all right, we can do it, and bingo, that's how you have it. The product is substituted for, the kosher glycerin is substituted for the non-kosher glycerin. That is 1935, but that becomes the model for kosher certification later on, where food companies discuss with rabbis what's in the product. The rabbis use knowledge of chemistry to see what these products are and where they come from, and then importantly work with the firms, the companies, to find ingredients that satisfy kosher requirements. In this way, these rabbis really become production consultants. They go far beyond simply being inspectors. They end up being advisors, if you will, investigators of how firms can find the kinds of ingredients that will make their products kosher. This is institutionalized today. These companies all work with Orthodox Union, people like that. They have what's called a universal kosher database, which is essentially a barcoded system of about 700,000 ingredients that you can draw from if you want to make a product kosher, and you can consult this database to find out ingredients. So this is really the way chemistry and production engineering is brought together with kosher law to generate the kinds of kosher foods we have today.
I understand Jell-O is also another food that there was some early controversy around if it was kosher or not.
Second. Jell-O is enormously controversial. And it has to do with deciding what it takes for an ingredient to become kosher. The issue for Jell-O was gelatin. And gelatin, of course, is derived from animal sources. But it doesn't look very much like the animal sources that it came from. I mean, gelatin comes from bones or hides of animals. But of course, when you get it in Jell-O, it looks kind of nice. It's kind of fluffy and kind of makes this very nice product. It's colorful. It doesn't look like, you know, bones and hides. And in the early 20th century, a lot of rabbis said, well, since gelatin is so different from the bones and hides, it's not the same thing. It doesn't count that they came from bones and hides of non-kosher slaughtered beef, for example, cattle. That's okay. It's transformed such that we'll consider it kosher and acceptable. So all sorts of gelatins are permitted into kosher food mid-20th century. 1950, rabbis, senior rabbis, Orthodox rabbis, noted rabbis, authorized Jell-O as kosher, a campaign that the kosher's manufacturer is very happy to promote all over the place and is a source of a lot of advertising on Jewish stations, Yiddish. There's a cantor, famous cantor, who sings a ditty for Jell-O. But there are opponents to this point of view. And the concern that the critics have is that if, you know, you can have a non-kosher ingredient called gelatin in Jell-O, what about other kinds of non-kosher ingredients? Could they also be in kosher food? What happens then to kosher food? What else is going to infiltrate into it? So there's a big divide over that. And then what tips the balance is the rabbis discover something that really shocks them. They learn that the gelatin that's in Jell-O actually comes from pigs. It's derived not from beef bones, but from pig skins. So you, in essence, you have in Jell-O pig skins. You have pork. And after all, there's no doubt that pork is prohibited under Jewish law. So they revoke the certification of Jell-O. There's a process of a lot of debate in the course of 1950s, but by 1960, it's clear that gelatin from non-kosher sources is non-kosher. And with that, anything which comes from non-kosher sources is also non-kosher. It's a very stringent requirement for what makes kosher law. And Jell-O is kind of the tipping point which forces that decision to be made.
Has the company responded to that and tried to create products not made using that gelatin?
Well, that's a very interesting question about what happened. You see, the manufacturer of Jell-O continues to insist that it's kosher. And if you go and you get a Jell-O package off the shelf now, you'll see a K on the side. Now, this K isn't surrounded by a circle or a star or anything like that. And that K is simply a letter placed in the package by the manufacturer because they have a rabbi who sends them a letter every year and says, I consider gelatin in Jell-O to be kosher. That is not accepted by the other rabbis in the world of kosher certification. And what's really interesting is that all the manufacturers of foods also do not accept the idea that gelatin from non-kosher sources can be kosher. You'll find nowhere in the food system do manufacturers make the claim that if they put gelatin in, say, yogurt, very common of gelatin in yogurt, that yogurt is kosher. So you have a rabbi who makes that claim, but you don't have manufacturers accept it. Instead, they go with the Orthodox Union and the major kosher certifiers who said no. Gelatin from a non-kosher source remains non-kosher. So you have a claim for on Jell-O, but you don't have it spread through the food system. The reason is actually very interesting, and it's somewhat surprising. You'd think that the food manufacturers would take the course of least resistance, that they would say, oh, great, we have a rabbi who says that gelatin is kosher, so we're going to start putting gelatin in all our foods. We're not going to worry about what the Orthodox Union says. But they don't do that. They don't do that because they want to have one standard of kosher. Food manufacturers want consistency, they want predictability, and they want one kosher standard. They don't want three or four or two. They don't want anything like that. And so since the dominant certification organizations say it's not kosher, they go along with that. Because if they don't, you end up with a lot of friction in the system and complications about whether your products are in fact kosher.
Interesting. Have there been other ingredients like gelatin that science has been able to find out the source and determine if it is kosher or not, like the Jell-O?
If other similar issues of a controversies, it's not so bad about whether it's kosher, but there's always an issue about what's dairy. Under kosher law, you're supposed to keep your meat separate from your dairy and not mix them at meals. And there was a huge controversy, if you can believe it, in the mid to late 60s over non-dairy creamers. These are the creamers, of course, that white powdery stuff. It's generally pretty awful that sometimes we're forced to use for our coffee or tea because there's no refrigeration and we use something like that. The non-dairy creamers still use something called sodium caseinate, which is a derivative of milk. But it's transformed from that milk, very much in the way that gelatin is transformed from its original source. It's a powder. It doesn't look like the milk. And it goes through a chemical process by which you're pulling the sodium caseinate out of the milk itself and separating it from the lactose, which is the more important part of milk. So rabbis disagreed in the mid to late 1960s about whether this was a dairy product, because it clearly was not milk. It was only one ingredient that came out of a milk, but did that mean enough that it was milk? Was it transformed in the process of being removed? And the answer was very similar to gelatin, that it was not. That it was not transformed such that the original nature of it had been changed. It came from milk, therefore it is milk. Therefore, the irony is that kosher certifiers consider non-dairy creamer to be milk, to be dairy. And if you look at a package of a non-dairy creamer, you'll see a U or a K followed by a D for dairy, because to them, it's a dairy product.
Have you seen any products that maybe weren't kosher before that have now become kosher because of modern developments in science?
Well, I mean, there's lots of examples. I mean, one of the most famous examples was the Oreo cookie, which became kosher in 1997, and essentially that required replacing lard with other kinds of baking ingredients. And I don't know all. I mean, that's probably a secret of the firm, but it wasn't so simple as simply taking out animal fat and putting in vegetable fats, because you're baking a lot of goods and there's different temperatures involved. But when something like that can happen, it's because the firms have developed a different cocktail of ingredients to substitute for that kind of a product. You see that happen with various kinds of yogurts that try to avoid using gelatin because of gelatin's products. So you do see efforts to manipulate products so that you can make them kosher. There still are some barriers. I'll just mention a couple. Cheese is a challenge for kosher manufacturing, because to make cheese you have to use an ingredient that causes the milk to curdle. And under kosher law, that can't just be plain old rennet that you take from the belly of any old animal. It's got to be from a kosher animal. And so kosher cheeses can be more of a challenge to generate. And it often means that, say, that salad dressings that have cheese, it's harder to make them kosher because the cheese often is not kosher. And then there's a huge obstacle for Passover, which we haven't talked about. Passover, the Jewish tradition is you can't consume leavened grains in the course of Passover. And in the European tradition, there's a rule called kitniot, which means you can't use products that are like grains, such as corn. You can't consume corn during Passover, according to that tradition. The problem for certification, for kosher certification on Passover, is there's so much high fructose corn syrup that is all through our food system. And if you have corn syrup in your food, it can't be kosher for Passover. It can be kosher regularly, but not for Passover. So there are some companies, such as Coca-Cola, that eliminates the corn syrup, uses sugar, and Coke that's kosher for Passover now, in addition to the glycerin problem that was resolved a long time ago, only has sugar in it. But most food manufacturers are not willing to go to those lengths to reformulate products to substitute sugar for corn syrup. And that is a huge obstacle for the expansion of certification for Passover.
Have you seen manufacturers in recent years start to incorporate more kosher ingredients into a wide variety of products, or really look at changing the ingredients in their products?
There's a huge increase in kosher certifying products in the 1990s, and that really tips the scale. I mean, it was growing through the 70s and the 80s, but the 90s is really where it's transformed. And there's two things going on to explain that. One is that there's some very thorough market research done in the late 80s, which starts showing that a majority of kosher consumers are not Jewish. That there's a 1988 survey which shows that only 1 in 4 consumers who look for kosher symbols are in fact observant Jews who are eating kosher. That consumers who are lactose intolerant, i.e., they're concerned about milk allergies. consumers who are vegetarians, consumers who are Muslims, are using these kosher symbols to get information about what's in their foods in a reliable manner. They're trusting the rabbis for that purpose. You also have consumers who just are suspicious about the food system, suspicions that are widespread in the 1980s and 90s, who believe, probably correctly, that having rabbis as a third party certifying the food, it makes it more reliable. It's encouraged by the Hebrew national advertisements that people probably heard. We answer to higher authority. Again, the idea that having rabbis involved means the food is probably safer and better. So those two things together, that demand by non-Jewish consumers encourages firms to shift to kosher certification, because it's not just observant Jews they're reaching out to. There's other populations that are interested in that. The other thing which happens is really completely separate but related is that the development of computer technology in manufacturing, these very sort of, you know, hard to figure out manufacturing control systems, become much more sophisticated in the 90s with computers, and it becomes a lot cheaper to monitor the production in factories to make sure they're kosher. I mean, if you have a factory making food that's kosher and non-kosher in the same operation, 1970s, for example, you had to have a rabbi sitting in that factory watching what was going on. And that's expensive because you've got to pay to have, as a rabbi or a supervisor, watching everything which goes on. By the 90s, you have computer systems that are doing it for you, that you still have rabbis or supervisors, so kosher supervisors, watching the factories, but they don't have to be there 24/7. And that makes it far cheaper for firms to produce kosher products. It makes the inspection cost far less. You put those two things together, and so the 90s are really where you have a tipping point, where you have firms much more widely using the kosher symbol in order to making their foods kosher, in order so they can put the kosher symbols on their foods.
Has that sustained today? Is there a same, is it kind of leveled off, or is there a same level of increase in manufacturers putting kosher symbols on their products?
Well, right now, it's pretty clear. It's leveled off, but pretty much, you know, depending upon the area, 30 to 40% of new food products are kosher certified. That is fairly steady year in, year out now. And that's a lot of products. There has, though, been a steady increase sort of behind the scenes in the number of kosher certified ingredients. And that's part of the story that I'm telling, that you have to have kosher ingredients in order to make food kosher. And since you have that many products kosher on the market, that has what I call in the book the food chain effect, that manufacturers of the ingredients that go into food are increasingly, really, a very almost comprehensively making their ingredients kosher certified if they can, because it opens up wider markets for them. I mean, they're selling not just to the very small proportion of observant Jews who are buying products, or the non-Jews who are buying kosher products, but to major manufacturers who are making Oreo cookies, who are making canned tomatoes, making all sorts of products that want their ingredients in those products to be kosher certified. Indeed, need to if they're going to have their factories kosher certified. The ingredient manufacturers want to be on the universal kosher database. They want to be in the list that the Orthodox Union maintains so that they can get picked when you have new products being made. So you go back up the food chain to like flavors, food colors, and you're talking 80, 90% of those that are introduced these days are kosher. Indeed, you virtually have, the only ingredients that you have that are not kosher certified are ones that can't be kosher. You know, for example, if it comes from lobster, you know, or seafood, kind of a product. Those are very, or if gelatin is necessary for that to take place. Or in some cases, there's some food colors that come from insects. Carmine comes from an insect color. So you have that, you know, limitation. But the more you have those ingredients kosher certified, the easier it is for people to make kosher certified products. So if, for example, you're a entrepreneur in Brooklyn and you want to make some super duper ice cream that's different from any ice cream on the market, with flavors that nobody else has, to get a niche, you know, part of the market niche, with different colors that anybody else has, and you want to make it kosher, you can work with the Orthodox Union, use the Universal Kosher Database to pick out those ingredients that will allow the product to be kosher. which of course makes it so much easier for you to do that because you don't have to investigate themselves. You basically call in the kosher certifiers, not just to certify the products, but to help to create the recipes, to help design it. So if you're selling hipster ice cream in Brooklyn, you can also sell it to all the Orthodox Jews in Brooklyn and have that market covered as well, which of course you probably would like to do if you want to break into the marketplace.
And you mentioned even African Americans as a population segment that kosher products, either the marketers have appealed to them or just the consumers. Could you speak to that?
Well, there's two pieces to that. I mean, African Americans, many of them, of course, not a majority, but a significant minority are Muslims. And Muslims overwhelmingly rely upon kosher symbols when they purchase food because they trust Orthodox rabbis to not permit pork products into their foods. And this whole conversation we've had about glycerin and about gelatin is instrumental in providing Muslims with the confidence that these Orthodox Jews are serious and will not allow any pork into their products. So kosher really functions in a very important way for Muslims. And halal certification is not as well advanced. It's not as well articulated, so very much a tremendous reliance upon kosher symbols, and that's a very important market for, you know, for kosher food. So African American consumers, Muslims, very important support for kosher food and for kosher certification. There's also, in addition, has been a long historical relationship between kosher wines and the African American community. It's not well known now, but it was in its day that in the 1950s, the vast majority of Manischewitz wine consumers were African Americans. That was the principal market for Manischewitz wine, and Manischewitz was really the first crossover kosher product. Crossover, in other words, crossing over outside of the Jewish community to a largely Christian community. Now, these are not Muslim African Americans; these are Christian African Americans as well. And it's a wonderful story of marketing and also convergence, where the African Americans moving from the South after World War II and during World War II encounter Jewish wine. That was traditionally sweet wine in neighborhoods that they shared with Jews and developed a liking for Manischewitz, in part because of the sweet, but also Manischewitz had a very religious overtone and was acceptable to a very often religious community. And as I've been giving talks about this book, you know, I get these stories, which now 3, 4, 5 stories, and it's not evidence, but these are stories of African Americans who used Manischewitz wine as a sacrament before they ate their Easter meal or before they sat down for Thanksgiving. They would hand out little glasses, little tulip glasses, maybe an ounce, and they'd say the grace on the meal, and they'd drink the Manischewitz, and then they would sit down and have their meal. So Manischewitz, very, very proper. Sammy Davis Jr. becomes a big their face man on television, makes advertisements for Manischewitz. So it's a huge, huge market for Manischewitz. There's also a contemporary reflection of this, which is the popularity of Bartonura Moscato wine among African Americans. I mean, it's a different company, but Moscato is a largely sweet wine, low in alcohol. It's about the same alcohol content as beer. And about 5 or 6 years ago, Moscato became very popular in the hip-hop community. And the Bartonura Moscato, which is a kosher Moscato wine, became one of these wines. They're very high. It's relatively high in Moscato, very, very popular. And so Moscato is the largest selling wine now for Bartonura, winemaker. Very important source. They sold 1 million gallons last year. And they advertise heavily in the African-American community and hip-hop circles through social media, other kinds of activities. So there's a long relationship, if you will, between the African-American community and these wines. Very interesting.
What do you think has made it popular in the hip-hop community? That's really fascinating.
There's a lot of speculation about why. I mean, the Moscato was the beginning of that. And what is said, I'm not sure if it's true, is that it's fizzy, like champagne. It has a champagne-like feel to it, celebratory. And it's also low alcohol. I mean, champagne wine is about 12% alcohol. Moscato is about 5 or 6% alcohol. So if you want to use it as a beverage, in other words, if you want to have a party, you want to celebrate, and you're not really using it to get intoxicated, it's a terrific source for that. You know, you can celebrate with it, and you can be able to drink a lot more. Sort of like the way people drink light beer, in the sense that you have a wine, and it's sweet, and it's fun. So I think that's part of it. In terms of why Bartonura always positioned themselves as a good to better Italian wine. It was Bartonura is a brand created by the Royal Wine Company. A very interesting story behind that. And it's made in Italy by Italian winemaking firm. There's not actually a Bartonura company. It's a brand. And they marketed very much towards the higher end market. And when they saw the popularity of Moscato in the African American community, they began marketing it as a better, not necessarily top of the line, but a better one. And they created a very attractive blue bottle that gave off senses of refinement and class, sort of a champagne-like bottle, and it worked for them. It worked for them.
Lots of really fascinating stories. The you mentioned the database. So when exactly was that created?
About 2007 is when the database is created. I mean, there's steps along the way. I mean, it's not as if it comes into existence just then. But it really originates, if you will, in the 90s when you have computerization and you have the capacity to take these ingredients and these sources and to create a systematic base of it. And before that database was made available, these various certification organizations had these records in their offices. And so if you were a firm and you wanted to make something kosher, you could consult with them and they would go look. The database made it a lot easier because then a rabbi can go on site, open up his computer, and can talk with the companies about that. When a firm is certified kosher by the Orthodox Union, they get access to the database. So what they can do, if they want to create a new product, they can actually access it themselves. And without having to go through the Orthodox Union, they can start off looking at products that are kosher. So the process of getting the product certified kosher by the Orthodox Union is easy because then it's already a certified product. They have records of it, and it's acceptable.
So it's online. It's online categorized.
It's obviously it's password protected. You have to be client that. There's various kinds of controls. But yes, you could access it in that manner. It's constantly updated.
And then going back to just what makes a food kosher, are there still kind of discrepancies about what makes a food kosher, or has that pretty much been resolved in a sense?
Well, I would say that the principles have been worked out about industrial kosher food, that some of them very, very basic, that everything has to be kosher, that you can't have a non-kosher ingredient in a product, no matter how small it is. The way that it's kosher because of the source. These are important principles. But there are endless complexities. There are endless permutations of how this can happen. And so there's constant debate about what you can and can't do. And there are differences, often minute, between the certification organizations, but they can result in all sorts of conversations. Part of it has to do with the ingenuity of food manufacturers, who always are coming up with new kinds of ingredients, new ways of doing things. You have this phenomenon now of enzymes that are used in various kinds of products that are grown on certain kinds of medium. So the medium that they're grown in, that could be kosher or non-kosher. Did it have to be kosher? Well, that's not necessarily clear because the medium is not part of the product. It's sort of like saying, is soil kosher? Does that have to be kosher? But to be safe, they said the enzymes have to be grown in a kosher medium. And that was a debate because it's part of a figure out science. So you don't have the kinds of, Jell-O type controversies you have now over what should be the case. But you can get controversies over new developments in science and how to understand those. A lot of also debates about what happens in cooking and processing and things like that, because manufacturing, again, is always changing. And when you have new kinds of processes, you can often have conversations, about that.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground. Is there anything else you'd really like to add?
I'll just add this, that if you buy a food today, you'll see there's all sorts of marks on it. You might see a genetically modified free mark on there. If it's a seafood, you might see sustainably harvested, wild caught. You might see organic on there. For organic's very commonplace. These are all third-party certifications. These are all, in a way, copies of the kosher method, where you take a firm or an organization or not-for-profit, some sort of organization that has stature, It establishes a trademark, which certifies the product as X, Y, and Z, and then contracts with firms to authorize use of its trademark on its packages, attesting that the product is what it says it is. And that's a way of avoiding both the government and also the firm as providing that kind of authorization, and it provides knowledge to consumers about what's in those kinds of products. The point I'd make here is that kosher is the first one. Kosher really is the model for what's now developed into a much more widespread practice of the use of third-party certifications on food products.